Pollock. Last I spoke here, I don't know, a year or two ago, and serving the chapel and the big cross is hanging down. Kind of a daunting task, but I actually spent a lot of time in this church. I'm a Jew who's married to a former Catholic who's now a Methodist. I'm all confused with who God is, but I didn't have one before I got in the program. And I'm an alcoholic who found God through Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought all of it was really just a bunch of crap. And it took me a while to become a believer. They told me to just keep coming back. That's about the only advice I took in the beginning. I was running some numbers today just because we talk about this program being a one day at a time program. So I've got some years in the program, but I was calculating the number of days today. I've been alive as of today 23,589 days. It doesn't seem like that many days, you know. I'm an old fart, but that's a lot of days, I guess. And the amount of days before I came into the program was 8,343 days. I'm going to talk about those in a few minutes. After I came in the program, I now have 15,246 days. None of this means much, but I have spent now 65% of my life as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is... Forget the applause. I wasn't meant to. If I stay long enough, somewhere I'll get close to 100%. I can't quite figure that out, but I'm working on that. But I'm hoping to die sober. Not tonight necessarily, but I didn't start out to be an alcoholic. I think the first thing I wanted to be was a veterinarian. Then I had to learn science, and I quit that right away. But I was one of those strange people that we don't hear about much in AA who never felt like they quite fit in. Always felt a little bit disjointed, disassociated from everybody. I grew up in a household with a mentally ill mother. And this was in the 50s. I was born a long time ago. But in the 50s, mental illness was not the kind of... stylish thing that it's become, where you hear, you know, if you're depressed, I mean, they talk about it on TV now. You can get medication for it, you know. They didn't used to advertise anything for mental illness on television. So I grew up feeling that I was different than everybody else, and my household was certainly different than everybody. My mother was in and out with suicide attempts, and back then, there weren't a whole lot of medications available for that. So this is something I didn't talk about to too many people. Maybe my closest friends knew that my mom was in and out of the mental hospital. But, you know, the way America was portrayed on television back then was sort of like if the Andy Griffith Show or Father Knows Best, or most of you probably don't even know what I'm talking about, but that's okay. But it was a whole different world. You didn't even have husbands and wives sleeping in the same bed. You know, they always had two separate beds. So I felt different. I felt apart from everybody. Didn't fit in. Always felt a little bit uncomfortable. I remember my second sponsor telling me that I asked him what the purpose of sobriety was. And he said, to be comfortable. And I said, I got to get a different sponsor. This is, you know, it's not nearly as profound as I need. And I've come to realize that just being comfortable is a pretty profound. Because I spent those first 8,000 and some days being pretty uncomfortable. Of course, what happens is that we discover something that makes us feel different. And that was, of course, alcohol. My first experience with alcohol, I was actually 6 months old. I don't remember this, but I was told that I drank a half bottle of perfume that was on the dresser next to my crib. So I don't know if that made an impression on me or not, But they didn't have to pump my stomach. The doctor said I'll probably just have a buzz. So I guess my first buzz was at 6 months, which maybe qualifies me to be here to begin with. I'm not sure. But I can remember being a family bartender when I was about 9 years old and drinking just little bits of drinks that people had left and remembering the feeling of, I didn't get drunk, but I just remember the feeling that I felt good. I felt relaxed. I felt happy. I felt warm. I felt like I belonged, which was different. And my next recollection is my first blackout. I think I was 15, and I came to in the shower thinking I was having a heart attack. It was really the dry heaves. I didn't know what the dry heaves were, but I was sure I was having a heart attack at 15. I have no recollection of who I was with. I was pretty sick. And, I have some idea who I was with, but I wasn't sure. I can't, even to this day, I'm not too positive. But I said to myself, standing in the shower having these wonderful dry heaves experience, that something I was to say to myself on numerous occasions thereafter, which was, I will never do this again. I've learned my lesson. Which lasted about 2 weeks until the next opportunity to drink came about. And I didn't realize till I came in the program that blackouts are not necessarily indicative of social drinking. I thought that if you drank enough, so you forgot a few things during the night, and or maybe half of the night or most of the night, but that's part of drinking. I didn't think there was anything unusual about blackouts. I didn't even know what a blackout was till I got here. I was just, all right, so you forgot a few things. You know. You got home, so that's okay. I tell this story about the culmination of my illustrious high school career, which involved virtually nothing of any magnitude. I was an okay student, nothing great. But we had this civics class run by this one teacher who decided we were going to have this senior trip to New York City, a cultural trip, to see the United Nations and the museums and all the cultural sites in New York. And at that time, the drinking age in New York was 18, so a few of us had this idea that, now we were getting booze all the time anyhow, but there was something really exciting about being able to go into a liquor store and get liquor at the age of 18 legally just by showing your driver's license. So that's what we planned for. On this trip, and we worked for months selling light bulbs and candy and accumulating all kinds of money so we could afford to have three busloads of students go to on this cultural trip. And we stayed in this place called the Times Square Motor Hotel, which they should have condemned probably 50 years before we stayed there. And directly across the hotel was a liquor store, which wasn't too uncommon in New York at that time. And I went in and I bought myself, I can't remember the second bottle, but the first bottle was something called lime vodka, which I thought was a great idea because it must go down very easily. It looks sort of like candy-colored stuff, so I figured that'll be okay. And so we ended up in the room at 10 o'clock in the morning on our first day in New York, drinking, starting to drink. And we drank till 4 or 5 and then went to this big Italian tourist place called Mama Leone's Restaurant. The guy next to me was passed out into his spaghetti. That's really the last recollection I have of that evening, because when I woke up the next morning, I was, and I understand they use this scenario to talk about, you may be an alcoholic, like you might be a redneck if, you might be an alcoholic if you wake up tied to a radiator in a chair with coat hangers, and the radiator was on, and it was hot, and I had no shirt on. Fortunately, I had pants on, but I woke up out of this blackout, tied to a chair with coat hangers, with burns down my chest from the radiator, and we had slept through a fire in the hotel. The whole place had been evacuated. And they came around to every room, you know, the security people, if they had security people, knocked on the door and told us to get out, and we told them to get out. You know, we weren't going anywhere because we were, well, I was tied to a chair, so I didn't realize it at the time, but the unfunny part of that is the floor below us, two Marines had started the fire by getting drunk and setting fire to the room with lit cigarettes, and two of them died. So one might think an incident like that might wake you up a little bit. But no, it was really just kind of, yeah, that was my badge of courage. I slept through a fire, people died, but I didn't evacuate. I was proud of that, literally proud of that. That's the twisted thinking of someone who might be an alcoholic. Never crossed my mind that, I was an alcoholic. I had no spirituality. I had grown up as a Jew. And we were sort of like what my wife calls the C&E Christians, you know, only shows up at church twice a year, Christmas and Easter. We went at the big two holidays that the Jews all show up for. But there was never any talk of God. Anytime my mother was in the hospital, nobody ever said to me, you know, you should pray about this. Pray about to who, what, you know. There was a God out there that existed in a synagogue somehow, but it was sort of like this spirit that, you know, got mad at people and the Old Testament stuff, and that's okay. But as far as having God a part of my regular life, it never really occurred to me, and it was never a discussion in my family at all. And all the turmoil that we went through with my mother, when nobody ever turned to God, we turned to shock treatments. And those work sometimes. But what happened was she would always get sick again. So I developed this idea that no matter how good things were going to be, they were always going to get shitty at some point. And I still have to fight against that, despite all these other 15,000 and some days in the program where things have gone pretty well since I came in the program. I still have this idea that, the anvil is right, you know, like the cartoons. You walk around the corner and the anvil drops out of the window. There's always an anvil that's coming down. When I don't think about God too much, that anvil's always out there. But when I think about God, there's no anvil. And if in case an anvil drops, it's probably going to miss me. If it hits me, that's the end anyhow, so who cares, right? Anyway, this is my New York trip lasted 24 hours. They loaded everybody back on the bus. People were missing. They couldn't find people. I mean, it was a total disaster. I mean, you know, we worked, I don't know how many months for this cultural trip, and all we saw was Mama Leone's in the liquor store. Strangely enough, I decided to go to college in New York University. I grew up in Pittsburgh, by the way. Most Steeler fans are drinking right now, I think, but decided to go to school in New York. I got a partial scholarship, which was interesting because I wasn't that great a student, but I think they liked the fact that I came from this dysfunctional household, and I used to use that when it was profitable. Growing up in a household that had, you know, these kinds of problems that most people didn't encounter, but so I could use that to my advantage periodically. So I guess I can date myself at this point. It doesn't matter. What the hell? I mean, I've already told you how many days I'm alive, so you can work it out with a calculator, I guess. But this was 1967. So I must say that part of my story involves drugs other than alcohol, and I know people are going to, you know, freak out about that, but especially in this crowd. I don't know anybody under 50, actually, that hasn't had things other than alcohol in their system at some point, some more than others. So this is the dawn of people discovering marijuana and things like that. And I lived in this dormitory that was literally like an insane asylum. They had different floors were different drugs and different, you know, I mean, but everybody drank. That was a given. But then people were discovering pot for the first time, many of them. And strangely enough, I never participated in any of that when I was at New York University. I only lasted a semester there because I knew I mean, a typical night at the dormitory in 1967 was bedtime was about 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd get up for 8 o'clock classes sometimes, not all the time, but whenever we could. And I realized that I wasn't going to stay sober. I shouldn't say that. That was not in my vocabulary. I realized I wasn't going to graduate in that atmosphere. So I transferred back to Pittsburgh to Duquesne University, which was like the polar opposite of NYU. It was a Catholic university that hadn't heard of marijuana yet, I don't think, or at least the staff hadn't. Some of the students had, of course, but I figured that was a place that I could keep myself under control. For some reason, I just knew. And interestingly enough, because I was monetarily challenged in New York University, I didn't get drunk all that much because I just couldn't afford it. As a matter of fact, my history has shown the only time I was at all not drinking was when I didn't have money. Economics has a lot to do with, when you stay sober sometimes. Or not drink, I shouldn't say sober, but I came back to Duquesne University and everything really went to hell in a handbasket in a short period of time because I started to associate people that were doing a lot more than drinking. And I, one thing that was true with me is once I took a drink, there were no more inhibitions about anything else that was introduced to me at that point. Try this, sure, why not? You know, drinking was always the gateway to all of this stuff for me. And over a period of time, things that I thought I would never do, I began to do on a fairly regular basis. And I found things that didn't give me blackouts. I found things that didn't give me the dry heaves. I found methods of intoxication that were much quicker than drinking. So I gradually went downhill, and periodically I would see a psychiatrist. I decided that clearly my problem was due to my mother and my background as a child and this difficult existence that I had in those few 8,000 days. That, you know, my mother really just screwed me up, and if I learned how this all happened, I would be able to control what I was doing and get off some of this other stuff and get back to, you know, drinking more socially, which I never did, you know. I know this prayer that we all become social drinkers, some of us have. That's bullshit. I mean, let's face it, nobody in AA really wants to be a social drinker. What I want is to get drunk as much as I can with no consequences. That's what I want. Who the hell wants two drinks? I mean, two drinks were just, I mean, that was the very, very beginning, two drinks, you know. After that, it was who counts, you know. There's no counting. The only thing to count is money. When the money runs out, that's when the drinks run out. I used to buy drugs in bulk, thinking that it's a little like Sam's Club, you know. I'm going to buy a big bag of this stuff because it's going to last a long time, you know. I'll be economical. Didn't work. Somehow it went fast. I don't know why. I wasn't even giving it away. And so periodically I would sort of get under control by going to the psychiatrist who absolutely, he knew nothing about addiction in retrospect. He knew nothing about it. So he put me in like group therapy with a bunch of neurotics. And not that I wasn't neurotic, but I was also an alcoholic, but he didn't realize it. So he thought that some amount of self-knowledge would actually help me. And that's what I thought. And the book tells us, forget about it. No amount of self-knowledge is going to help us. But I was convinced that if I understood why my childhood did what it did, I would be able to get this thing under control, which was periodically just completely out of control. And when you're doing things other than alcohol, you have to worry about the police and, you know, things like that. And I was pretty careful most of the time. Got a Psychiatry wasn't working for me. In fact, I was getting worse. The more self-knowledge I had, the worse it got. And this idiot said to me one day, he said, you know, it's amazing you're not in jail, given your background. That was the best thing I could have heard. I mean, all right, so I'm using this other stuff, but I'm not in jail, so I must be doing okay. And see, I always had a plan for my life. My plan for my life was to be somewhat like, as I was saying at a meeting the other day, my two heroes in life were Clint Eastwood and James Bond. And Clint Eastwood is Dirty Harry, not Clint Eastwood, the person, whoever he might be. He's one of the few people that's actually older than me now, but Dirty Harry, right? Guy's, you know, never afraid of anything. Never afraid. James Bond drinks, smokes, chases women, kills people, has this actual license to kill, which I thought would be a great attribute for people you had a resentment against. You killed somebody. Yeah, I have a license. I'm sorry, you know. I don't know who issued that license, but that's what I wanted, you know. I mean, I had the whole thing down. You know, you had the gold Dunhill lighter and all this crap. I mean, this is, you know, some people wanted to be doctors. I wanted to be James Bond, but I wasn't close to that. I mean, I was more like Wally Cox or Woody Allen was probably a lot closer. I was closer to Woody Allen than James Bond. But in any event, I came up with this plan. I had this girlfriend that we hooked up with. See, I was always concerned also that if I only had the right girlfriend, I could straighten out. If I only had the right job, I could straighten out. If I had a better car, I could straighten out. If I didn't live at home, you know, with my parents, because I couldn't afford to live anywhere else because I was running through so much money, that I had to stay with mom and dad, who thought I was really, they didn't know what I was doing. They were totally dumbfounded by the whole thing. And so I had this girlfriend, and she was doing the same thing I was, and we were two addicts and alcoholics. We didn't call ourselves that. We didn't realize that, of course, but we thought we were in love. And I said, well, let's live together. And I figure if we live together, you know, I'm almost 21 now, you know, I'll get more mature. And then she said, no, we have to get married. Okay, we'll get married. Really a smart move. And I really thought that getting married would somehow transform me into some mature person where I could put aside all this craziness. And my father-in-law had some money, and he offered us, and we were doing, well, let's put it this way. We were spending, and what year was this, 1971, we were spending $200 or $300 a day on escapades. Some of you may have heard of Lou Reed, who just died from the Velvet Underground. He's one of my heroes. And he had one song called Waiting for My Man. And that was my theme song, because I spent a lot of time waiting for people for hours, hours. At this time, I was actually a student teacher at an all-black high school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and this is my last semester. And at this point, my drinking and other escapades had taken me to the fact where I had to go home at lunch and get some drugs, or I had to go to the bar and have shots and beers to calm down. Up to then, I could wait till about 5 p.m. to start what I was going to start. And at that point, you know, I wasn't doing a great job student teaching, which I feel bad about. I can't make it up to those kids. And there were some really good kids in those classes. But so we decided to get married. And my father-in-law said, well, I can either give you some money or you can have a big wedding. Well, that took about 30 seconds of real hard deciding. We took the money. Got married. This is in December of 1971. And a typical day for me, if I was not doing what I normally did, depending on what the sources were. A typical day for me was drinking this Greek liqueur called ouzo, followed by about 15 or 20 Percodan. I mentioned a drug there. I'm sorry if I offended anybody, but that to me, that was a straight day. Okay? Because I'm not talking about going around in a daze. I'm talking about just feeling normal. Okay? But I would, at this point now we're spending $300, $400 a day for something that lasts about 30 seconds. And I would spend hours waiting for it. And so in the first 30 days after our marriage, this is what our daily life was like. I was working. I was still working. I was functioning. I wasn't too bad. One day I said to my new wife, who I didn't know outside of drugs and alcohol, I said, "We're going to die if we keep this up." A moment of lucidity, they call it. Maybe it's a spiritual awakening. Maybe it's the grace of God. I don't know. It wasn't any different than any other day. We'd get high. She'd throw up. We'd have dinner, which consisted of German chocolate cake about 12:30. And then go to bed. That was our daily routine. We were pretty sick. I couldn't control it anymore. And I said, "We're going to die." Why I felt any different that day, I don't know. But she said, "Well, what are we going to do?" I said, "We'll call our family doctor and see what he says." So I called the family doctor. And I told him just a little bit of the truth. You know, couldn't tell him the whole story because it was a little too much for anyone to hear. He says, "Okay, you're going to the hospital. We're going to put you in this mental hospital." Now, this, interestingly enough, was one of the same mental hospitals my mother had been in, called St. Francis Mental Hospital in Pittsburgh. It looked like Frankenstein's castle. It was up on a hill, this old brick, dirty building. And this is where they put people for depression, which I could never understand. It was the most depressing building. But that's where they put people who had all kinds of psychological problems. They put me in the psycho ward for whatever reason. I mean, it was locked, doors locked, you know, like, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. My roommate was a sort of a violent guy. They had to subdue him a couple of times. But we got medication, so we went on this detox program, and I get introduced to a Dr. Twersky, who is actually a world-renowned expert on addiction and has written several books, and actually was a distant cousin of my family's. And I'd heard about him, but I never met him. So this is 1 month after our marriage. You can imagine what it's like to tell your in-laws. "Well, guess where we are?" I mean, it was like honeymoon time. And here, "Where are you?" "Well, we're in St. Francis Mental Hospital." And there we were. It was very romantic. She was on one floor, I was on another. We were able to pass notes to each other during the day. And then we had this one-hour meeting every day with Dr. Twersky, who would ask us various questions about, "Well, do you think you can drink? Do you think you can smoke pot? What do you think about this other stuff? And can you get off of this and stay on that?" And he said, "We can drink. Drinking's not a problem. You know, we can smoke." I had given up on pot a long time ago because it made me nervous, but I needed to be more subdued most of the time. That was my choice. I needed to be subdued. So he said that we were there about the seventh or eighth day and going through this detox, and he said he had opened up this rehab center. They just opened up in January. This is the end of January and beginning of February, 1972. And he said, "I have this new place called Gateway Rehabilitation Center. I think you ought to go there. It's a 28-day program. You want to go?" And I said, "Sure," because I knew if I got out right away, it wasn't going to be good. I still hadn't admitted, of course, that I was powerless over anything, but I knew I was out of control. So we went to this 28-day program where they put us in with a bunch of alcoholics for some reason. And we learned somewhat about the 12 steps, and it's okay for you people. I was 22 years old. I was way too young to be an alcoholic. But I needed to get things under control, so I had a 90-day plan. Another brilliant plan of mine, and you know, if I could stay completely dry for 90 days, I'd be able to go out and be a social whatever, social drink taker, social drug addict, I don't know. Wasn't quite sure what I was going to do, but you know, be able to go out and have a couple of drinks with the guys and the girls and control it, like most people did. I got out on a Saturday, and they kept my wife a couple of more days. They told us specifically, we cannot stay together. Big mistake to stay together. And because if we stay together, the chances of both staying sober were slim to none, and one was going to go out, and the other person would be dragged down with them. And we actually didn't listen to that, and they were correct. We stayed together 25 years, but and sober, strangely enough, and then broke up because she drifted away from the program and for other reasons. But we had two wonderful children from that marriage that have now given me grandchildren, strangely enough. So I'm not only old, I'm a grandfather, but my kids have never seen me drunk, and my grandchildren certainly haven't seen me drunk, and I hope that I can say when Grandpa goes, we never saw Grandpa drunk, you know. That would be nice. So I got on a Saturday, and actually the first meeting was actually called the Young People's Group. Back then, that was anybody under the age of 50. And here I was. They told me I had to go to this meeting, and it was Saturday night. And I'm sitting in my apartment by myself, which was always a dangerous thing. And sitting on that table is the bottle of Ouzo right across from me, and I wanted that more than anything. Anything. I wasn't an alcoholic, but all I wanted to do was drink. But I went to the meeting. I didn't drink. And I'm not sure why, except for the grace of God that I didn't believe in. I was a Jew, an atheist, and a non-alcoholic. And if you're all three, it's really hard to be in this program. You know, it creates some real challenges psychologically. But and then you come and read this stuff, and they mention God and admitting to people, and it's wacky. Now you hear about some people who come to AA and, you know, they sit there and they say the first time, I feel like I'm at home. Not how I felt, you know. I felt when I sat down in that meeting, this is the worst day of my life. I didn't feel like that. I didn't even mention the part that I spent the night I spent in jail when I got picked up at a party. I didn't feel that. I didn't feel when they put me in the psycho ward. That wasn't so bad. But sitting at an AA meeting, it can't get any worse than this. I mean, this is where the dregs of society go, right? I mean, just look around. You can tell. Of course, I didn't realize it was the best night of my life. It took me a long time to get there because I didn't admit I was powerless over alcohol. That was a hard thing to do because I knew what that meant. See, they were talking about this one day at a time, but what they really meant was one day at a time forever. You know, like 15,000 and some days without drinking. That's what they're really talking about. Don't give me this shit with one day at a time. I know what you're talking about. I was talking about you're telling me you haven't had a drink in 5 years. That can't be possible. Could not be possible. I mean, the idea of not drinking or not taking something was terrifying because, I mean, spent years. How do you live? Life is difficult. What the book tells us in some places, or different books, life is difficult. Sometimes it's a bitch. How do you get through it? Well, what I found out was there's a replacement for all that stuff. It's called a higher power, which I didn't believe in. So first I had to conquer this thing about being powerless, and I went to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, just like they told me to do. And all I wanted to do was drink. And I'd leave a meeting and drive around in my car and think about going to the bar or getting a bottle at the liquor store or doing something or getting some other chemicals. But primarily it was drinking. I just thought, the other drugs, bad, 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 bad. Drinking, not so bad. At least it was legal. So after about 9 months of listening to people in the program, I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I was just struck by lightning. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. And in that meeting, the desire to drink left and has never returned. The obsession was gone, and I was able to move on in the program to the second step, which was another burden. And all I had was a little bit of an open mind, because everyone that I respected in the program had one thing in common. They all had a belief in a higher power, and they made use of that higher power. And I realized if I was going to survive, and the book tells us, if you don't have a higher power, you can't find a higher power, you're pretty much doomed. You're screwed. There's really not much hope. And what I had, at least by taking the first step, was some hope that maybe this could work. So this idea that I was I was looking for the chapter called We Atheists, Forget About the Agnostics. That was a little too open-minded for me. I needed a chapter about the atheists, who really didn't believe in anything. And I gradually came to believe. It doesn't say we believed, we came to believe. It's a gradual process. For some of us, it's more gradual than others. For me, it was really gradual. So it took me a couple of years to have a belief in a higher power. And what time am I supposed to be done? 8:40. Okay. All right. I got to talk about the other 15,000 days now. I won't go by each day, but I'll skip a few. My journey in the program has been somewhat extraordinary, because all these days in the program, I can only say that for what I've put into this, I've gotten out. It's like putting a dollar into the lottery and winning 100 and 200 million or 500 million or a billion. I mean, there's no monetary value you can put on it in terms of AA has given me everything I have, and I don't mean material things, although the material things are a result of character building that I've been able to establish in AA through the help of other people. People reached out to me when I was really kind of a schmuck. You know, but they didn't care, because I was just another alcoholic as far as they were concerned. So they reached out their hand to me and guided me through this process, because I never wanted to be an alcoholic. You hear these, I'm grateful alcoholic, I'm grateful. Grateful for what? What the hell are you grateful for? You know, don't have a job, you've lost your family, you're grateful for what? They're grateful for being in the program. I mean, being an alcoholic on the street, not so grateful. Being an alcoholic in AA, whole different deal. Whole different deal. Two guys get together in 1935. One alcoholic talks to another. And now we have this. All over the world, every night of the week, 7 days a week, everywhere, there's alcoholics. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And that's how this works. It's rather unbelievable. You know, it's a gift from God. They tell me I've got 5 minutes to wrap this up. I tried to work the steps to the best of my ability. I still do. I still have this search for God. You know, this last, how many days did I say I was in the program? 15,246 days. These last 215, they haven't all been good. They haven't all been great. In fact, the last year I've had a lot of anxiety and stress. One of my closest friends in the program died in January. That was sort of difficult, and much more difficult than I expected. And I've struggled with meditation, for one thing, throughout my sobriety. And I got serious about meditation just a few months ago. And I've been meditating twice a day, 20 minutes at a time, for the first time in my sobriety, and it's making a big difference, slowly but surely. So I'm seeking through prayer and meditation this conscious contact with the higher power, because it's the higher power that has replaced the alcohol. It's the higher power that's replaced. This is how I get through the day, through you people and my higher power. And the reason I keep coming back after all these days is because I look at the prayer of St. Francis, which I'm going to read quickly. Because I look at that and I determine how far away from that. To me, that's the goal of sobriety, is to become the kind of person that's reflected in the prayer of St. Francis. I got a lot of work to do. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where is discord, I may bring harmony, that where is error, I may bring truth, that where is doubt, I may bring faith, that where is despair, I may bring hope, that where are there shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. Boy, that's hard to do, self-forgetting. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. So that's what I'm striving for to the extent that I can. And I don't think about the prayer of St. Francis day in and day out. Don't get me wrong. I'm not approaching sainthood by any stretch. But that's the goal, as far as I'm concerned. That's the goal. That's the kind of person we're supposed to be as a result of working the steps and having a belief in a higher power. And I just have one thing to say about powerlessness. I tell people that I sponsor, I said, if you think you can come back and get another white chip, you haven't accepted powerlessness. Because I look at everybody, everybody's got a finite number of white chips. I only picked up one white chip. That's by the grace of God. God knows I wanted to drink. The one of the things that kept me sober was they said, well, you can drink tomorrow. Don't drink today. So I was always putting it off till tomorrow. I could drink tomorrow. But if you think you can get another white chip if you go out again, you better look again at the powerlessness issue, because powerless means you got zero power, nothing, zip, nada. So there may not be another white chip. I've been to too many damn funerals because someone thought, well, if I drink, you know, I can always come back and get another white chip. And for many of us, our white chips are gone. There aren't any more. And that's what's scary about this disease. So I want to read this closing little thing. It's actually on the back of a friend of mine's father died, and he put this prayer on the back. He wasn't an alcoholic, but I think this sort of sums up the AA way of life to some extent. And it's by Thomas Merton, who's this Catholic theologian. It says, my Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have the desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. I thought God was only with me in the last 15,000 days. No, he was with me the whole 23,000 and some days. I just didn't realize it. And none of us are alone when we're in the program, because we have all of you people to assist us. So keep coming back. Don't take the first drink. You can always drink tomorrow. Just don't drink today. Thanks.